This Week in Retronauts, live in Kyoto, it's Thursday afternoon. Hello, and welcome to Retronauts.
Hi.
Please, don't adjust your volumes. I am not Jeremy Parrish, nor am I Bob Mackey. This is Diamond Fight, and I'm here recording a very special episode of Retronauts with some special people in, indeed, the city of Kyoto, Japan, in spring. It's a lovely day today. And I'm here in the, podcasting saloon of Chuhai Labs?
The pod dungeon,
the
baby.
Pod dungeon, okay. And we are here. Well, first of all, right in front of me, this is, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Mark Lentz. I'm a producer and the business development manager here at Chuhai Labs.
All right. Thank you for coming, Mark. And thank you for being instrumental in arranging this meeting.
Well, thank you for coming.
And our number one guest, the star here, and I believe officially the CEO of Vitae.
The current Vitae.
Okay.
CEO.
Yeah. He's the current CEO. That's what we call it. Yeah, because one of these days he's out of here.
Okay.
Yeah. They remind me of that every day. I'm Giles. I'm a programmer at Vitae.
Okay.
Great, Giles. Come on. A little bit more.
Lead programmer.
We're here to talk about some of the work that you've done and some of the work that you're doing, and just to catch up on you, because you've had a fascinating career, if I say so myself. You know, I think our listeners would be very excited to hear the things you've experienced, the things you've made, the things you tinkered with.
The things I've seen.
Yes. So if we could just start, I would say, with your background. So first of all, I think it was recently your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. 50.
Yeah.
50th.
Barely made it.
The big 5-0.
How is that going for you so far? It's not far behind you.
I think it's all downhill from now.
Yeah?
But I'm trying to not think about it too much.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful for my 50s.
It doesn't get better.
Okay. He's a miserable fuck.
All right. Well, so far my 40s and better my 30s, but that's just me. But yeah, so you started out when you were a teen. You were programming games as a teenager?
I was programming Spectrum games when I was 12, 11.
Oh, so not even teenager.
10, 11, whatever.
Literal child.
Yeah, I think I had it for my 9th, 10th birthday party, Christmas present, birthday present, something like that. And that's where it all started, programming, taking a magazine and typing in the basic commands to make a game. That was, you know, how you made games.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we went on to actually making machine code games after that, where you type in the actual codes for the CPU to read and execute to make a much faster, better game out of it. And I guess that's where I started.
In programming at that era, I didn't go on to anything larger, but I definitely typed a bunch of things into my computer at home. And in America, we would read a lot of magazines, and the magazines would have a full program in the back. And if you could just sit there and type it all out, you would just get the program.
Yeah, the thing is, they would never work. There'd always be a spelling mistake or a mistake, because they never check these things. So you'd always, but maybe that was a good thing, because you'd always have to go and fix them yourself. So you'd put it in and it didn't work, and it was either your typo or their typo. So you'd have to go through and figure out how it worked in order to fix it, so you became a programmer out of it. So it was quite a good idea.
I know I spent many hours typing in a program from Mad Magazine that was supposed to draw a picture of Alfred E. Newman. And in the end, it started drawing it, and then something goes wrong, and then it just became garbled. And unfortunately, me as a kid, I didn't have the stick-to-itiveness to go through it, but that might have been part of the joke.
Yeah, I don't think... I mean, they didn't check the things in the magazine, because not many people were actually typing in. I think people just liked the idea of being able to do it, but not many people actually did it.
Were you sharing things with other folks, either in print or via tape cassette, or just make them for your friends?
Yeah, I think I used to program stuff on, put it onto cassette, and then send it to magazines maybe, and they'd review it and maybe post. I'm trying to think what it would have been. I think maybe sometimes you'd have cassettes taped onto the front of machines.
Oh.
And they'd put your game or your demo or whatever on there. you know, back in those days, all the programming would come from the audio on the cassette, and it would go into the audio port, and it would read it from that. Yeah, so I think that's how you'd share it. Either that, or you'd share it at computer clubs.
You're here. You're a child. You're making these programs. You're having, hopefully you're having fun with this. And how does that lead to Argonaut? Is it just you all get together and decide we're gonna make a programming team, or?
No, after the Spectrum, we moved on to the Amiga, and that's where the demo scene was happening. So you'd have these computer clubs where you'd swap your demos or you'd show what you were working on. And our group, our demo scene was like a 3D demo scene, so all the stuff we were making was 3D. And I saw this advert for a company in London called Argonaut that was, I think they just released Starglider 1, which was the first game they made, Jez made. And I applied there, said that I've got some 3D demos, and I sent them a demo, an Amiga demo, and then they called me up and said, come up. I think I was probably 16 then, 15, 16 maybe. So I quit school, went up to London, got a job.
And just started making games with the team, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I think there was maybe four of us in Argonaut at that time.
And was this before or after X on Game Boy?
Oh, way before.
Way before.
This was sort of before Game Boy, I guess.
Okay.
This would have been, you know.
Like 86, 87.
86, maybe.
So like Famicom and NES are out, but there's no handheld scene really.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely Famicom. Maybe the Famicom had just come out, maybe. That sort of thing.
And so some of the work at Argonaut, I know a lot of the innovation was involved with 3D. Because, you know, there were lots of 2D games, but it was your work in 3D that I guess got noticed by someone at Nintendo? Or how did that happen?
Well, I mean, so nobody was doing 3D at the time. It was basically just one company in the UK, which was Argonaut.
Uh-huh.
And they were famous because of Starglider, and then Starglider 2, which was like the filled polygon version of Starglider. And then on the back of that, they Jez went to Nintendo and said, look, we can make 3D on your NES, but it might require a bit of hardware to do it. And Nintendo said, well, let's see what you can do. So we showed them the software one and what it could potentially do if it had hardware. Jez somehow managed to get them to actually fund the hardware, you know, the Super FX chip to put on a SNES, not a NES. Yeah, and it was basically because we were the only company doing 3D, I guess.
And so you show them this work and they start to work with you, and then you're a teenager and they say, come to Kyoto? Like,
more or less.
Yeah?
More or less. I'd already been at Argonaut for, say, 3 years. I was sort of 18, 19 at that point. Mm-hmm. And then Nintendo wanted to make their own game, and they said, can you send some people over to make the game with us? And that was me, Dylan, and Krista. So that's what we did when we were sort of 18, 17, 18.
Now, I just have to ask logistically, you know, when I first came to Japan as a tourist in 2001, there was internet. You know, sure, I looked at some guides, I talked to some people, but I had a lot of internet research. I could just go on, oh, what does this look like? How do I get from here to here? But you're a teenager in the 80s. You get invited to a foreign country. Like, what? Where do you begin? Do you just did you start looking up, or do you just figure, oh, I'll just show up and they've got support for me? Or
To be honest, I didn't know where Japan was. You know, if you're a teen with no interest in Asia whatsoever, you don't really know what's the difference between China, Hong Kong, Japan, Taiwan, wherever. It's all just one. It's just Asia to you.
Right.
So I thought when I came here, there'd be at least English on the signs or something.
Uh-huh.
And there was no Romaji. There was no sort of, nothing for foreigners here. It was entirely kanji or, you know, katakana.
Especially here in Kyoto, which is definitely like old school. As Japan goes, this is like the old school part of Japan.
And I think it was the bus ride down from Itami, where it was the first time I was on a road thinking, you know, none of this is, I don't know what any of these signs mean or anything.
Uh-huh.
So that was when it hit me, I think.
Right. After you've already landed. It's like, oh, no.
I've already landed.
Oh, no.
But, you know, a lot of people at Nintendo spoke English at the time, or wanted to speak English, especially Miyamoto and Iguchi, whatever. You know, we didn't really have to speak much Japanese at first.
Can I ask, how soon after arriving do you meet Mr. Yamauchi?
Wow.
Yeah.
10 years?
10 year. Oh, so it was a long time.
I met him once, and it was terrifying.
I'm terrified when I look at still pictures of the man. I can't imagine meeting him in real life.
Yeah, and he never ventured around the company. He was always in his office or in between, whatever. But he'd never go around. Occasionally, once every couple of years, he'd do a tour, and that's the only time I met him. And we were all super terrified.
Did he know your name?
No, of course not. He didn't even know who I was or anything. Or why would he? I mean, there's like 600 people in the company, so I'm just one of the 600. I think he knew Miyamoto-san, Iguchi, maybe a few others, and that was it.
That's so dope.
I would hope you at least know Miyamoto at that point.
You would hope so, yeah.
But yeah, so you're a teenager, you're here, you're working in Japan, you're working on, and I guess so you arrive here and you're making games for upcoming systems. You're involved, so you're part of the Star Fox team? You're part of the Star Fox team. Star Fox works. I think we all agree, Star Fox works.
It didn't for a long time.
It didn't work for a long time.
But we have the frame rate was horrendous for a long time, and then we gradually optimized and took things out and made it actually playable. For a long time, it was 7 frames a second, whatever. And then the hardware, because we were working on hardware that was actually going to be double the clock speed by the time it came out. So it was already half the speed you're expecting. So we were just kind of banking on the fact that it's going to be the hardware, the actual final hardware is going to be faster. But of course, it wasn't as fast as we expected it to be. So yeah, it was quite tough getting an actual playable frame rate out of the thing.
And that was a game that during production, it sort of changed from fly anywhere to, oh no, we really need to stick on one path.
No, it was always a straight on-rails shooting game.
Oh, it was
basically, we used Star Blade as the inspiration, basically.
Oh, okay.
Because, you have things like, the side-scrolling shooters, like Xevious or Defender and stuff like that. It was a 3D version of one of those kind of games, where the aliens, you have aliens, waves of enemy, whatever, and then a boss at the end, and then you finish that next level sort of thing. So it was basically a 3D version of one of those kind of games. So there was never a discussion about, free roaming 3D.
But after Star Fox, how long would you say, because Star Fox, I think, is 93, give or take,
yeah.
A few years, at that point, do you already, when you're making Star Fox, are they already like, hey, we've got a new console, or is it, I don't know, how many years of leadway do you get on that kind of
news? There's always overlap. So I think after Star Fox, I'm trying to think of the timeline here.
You made Wild Tracks next.
Yeah, but they were also making Star Fox 2 at the time we were making Wild Tracks. And I guess by the time Wild Tracks came out and Star Fox 2 was winding up, that's when the N64 was just being made, not released, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the reasoning behind not actually releasing Star Fox 2 was the fact that it would overlap with N64.
Right, so it's sort of sat on a shelf for a very long time until emerging a couple years ago, much to everyone's surprise, on the Super Nintendo Classic.
Yeah. I was actually impressed they actually kept that ROM, or a working ROM that was, more or less bug-free.
Really delightful surprise, I think, for all parties involved.
I was actually working at Q Games at the time when that got announced at 3 in the morning. And so I was working at Q Games. My boss, Dylan Cuthbert, at the time, worked on Star Fox 2. And at 3 in the morning, I suddenly get like a dozen calls, people all trying to get like, oh, did you guys know about this? Try to get the inside scoop.
Obviously, it's 3D is a big part of this, and so they're gonna call you to sort of work on this sort of 3D work. So, I understand you had a very specific role in Mario 64.
Well, I guess before that, we were on the team that was designing the API behind the thing, the 3D interface. So we were going over to SGI every couple of months to talk to them about what we needed for the hardware, and then. you know, so I'd come back to Kyoto and I'd make little experiments and whatever to test the API or test the graphics chips and stuff. And the face would have been one of those experiments. So the face wasn't for Mario 64. It was just me playing around with the camera that you had on the SGI machines, mm-hmm. the development machines. And I thought it'd be cool to sort of just stick ping pong balls on my face and get the camera to recognize that and then sort of change the model in real time. And then Miyamoto walks past and says, oh, that's cool, let's use that. So it wasn't really designed for Mario 64. It was just turned out, you know, it worked quite well as a front screen for that.
They embraced it. They saw it.
Yeah,
When you're putting it's your screen on your face, did you make yourself into Mario? Or did Miyamoto's like, hey, what if you became Mario?
No. I think it was Koizumi-san who, I think this is right, he was the guy that made the Mario face, because I said, I've got this cool idea, I don't have any graphics, could you make a Mario face for it? So he went away and made it in like 10 minutes or something like that. And that became the Mario face. So it's always been Mario. Because, I mean, you know, you would do, wouldn't you? If you worked at Nintendo, it'd be the first thing you'd do.
Just start at the top.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, why, I mean, you know. I mean, okay, Luigi is there too, but also it's a coin flip.
Yeah. Also, but the great thing about Mario's face is it's got lots of stuff you can pull around, like his ears and his moustache, nose and stuff. So it kind of it fits really well with that idea. Much better than my face would.
I mean, speaking personally, you know, you first get that thing, you get it home, and this is what you're greeted with, and then it's like, oh, I can manipulate this.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a cheat mode, you know, a little thing to do while it's loading, whatever. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't supposed to be really, you know, put up front there. But it turns out it was actually quite good fun to play around with it.
Just a curtain raiser. Here it is. Here's your brand new toy. And yeah. Mario's grilling you, staring you right in your eyes, and then you can grab him in the eyes.
But I'm trying to think. I don't think you could actually play with it while it was loading. It was just, it loaded, you'd played with it, and then you press a button, and then it would actually load or something like that.
So you've made the face. You've got this face on there, and at what point do you transition from making, you know, getting this sort of experimental project to, all right, what about this full game that we want you to program?
So are you talking about Mario 64 or
the next thing that you make?
I'm trying to think here. So long time ago.
He's kind of leading up to this.
Yeah.
To this right here.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mean the snowboarding thing?
Yeah. That
yes.
One.
So the snowboarding thing was actually a skiing game originally.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, still in this experimental team, one of the things I had was real-time IK, which is an extension of the Mario face, actually, which is IK is where you have a string of bones connected together and you pull the end of the string and all the other bones move with it.
Uh-huh. That's that IK, is that internal?
Inverse
kinematics, okay.
And, you know, obviously that was quite an expensive operation to do on that kind of hardware, so nobody was really doing it, so I thought it'd be fun to make a taco skiing game where you have a character that's going down the ski slopes and all the animation is generated in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, an interesting experiment, and I did that and it was ridiculous.
Now, when you say taco, are you talking about the food or the octopus?
Both.
Okay.
No, the octopus.
Okay.
So, you know, so the arms and the ragdoll physics, whatever. Mm-hmm. So when you fell over, it looked really cool. And it, you know, it reacted like it would do in real life, but trying to get that to actually animate like a real human does is really hard. So we kind of gave up on the idea.
It sounds like you had quietly invented Octodad 20 years too
early.
Yeah.
I looked at Octodad and thought, oh, hang on. What's the other one? The walking one, Quop.
Quop. Oh yeah.
So I had that. That was one of my first demos. Was like basically a walking simulator where you just controlled where the legs went and the body followed along. It was great fun, but you know Nintendo wouldn't turn that into a game, would they?
They couldn't see it. They couldn't see the magic.
Quop, way ahead of it.
So you're working, so there's a skiing game and you're making this sort of silly octopus thing and it's funny, but it doesn't go anywhere. And then at some point it becomes snowboarding. I mean, I guess we can talk. I mean, I don't know. How much winter sports do you enjoy as people?
Now?
Yeah. Or in general, at the time, whatever.
At the time, not very much.
Not very much.
Because I came from the UK, don't have snow there.
Okay.
I came to Japan, there was nobody snowboarding. It was just skiing.
Mm-hmm.
But I am now. I'm a huge snowboarder.
Uh-huh.
You know, I go 20, 30 times a year, whatever. But at the time, not at all.
Mark, oh, are you a winter sports person?
I love winter sports. I couldn't afford it till recently.
Okay.
So I'm ready to get back into it next year.
I was, I could say at the time in the 90s, I would sometimes go skiing. Not as often as I would like, but I definitely enjoyed skiing. At the time, at least for me as a skier, I saw snowboarding as some sort of challenge. It's like, oh, I am on skis and that's snowboarding. But snowboarding seemed somehow dangerous.
The skiers reckless? Hated the snowboarders.
Yes, absolutely.
They were reckless. They were mm-hmm. banned on most mountains.
Yes, I had a sweatshirt as a child that said, "Friends don't let friends snowboard,"
wow.
And it was a picture. Like,
ooh,
a,
can
like
you
a,
have you still got that?
That's pretty
no,
tight.
I want that.
I'm afraid it might fit me today, but unfortunately, I got rid of it at some point, probably 1991
really
or so.
Cool to have, isn't it?
But so snowboarding was kind of this upstart, like lots of people skied, you know, but somehow snowboarding was here. But somehow, I guess, whether it was Olympics or it became popular with young people or X Games perhaps.
Yeah.
But then you've got, okay, so now Nintendo is making a snowboarding game. I mean, were you part of any of that conversation or just, oh, it's more fun to make one board instead of two?
I think Miyamoto-san wanted to make a skiing game. So that was the original thing. Then snowboarding came onto the scene, and it was really cool and hip, and the antithesis of skiing.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody wanted to be part of it.
Right.
And I said to Miyamoto, look, skiing's great, but, you know, on snowboarding, you can do tricks and stuff. You can do grabs and spins and grinding and stuff like that, all the things you can't do with skiing. So the gameplay benefits are huge with snowboarding. Compared with skiing, he said, all right, let's change it to snowboarding. So we change it to snowboarding. And it wouldn't have been the same game if it was stuck with skiing. It would have been Mario skiing or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But you yourself were not really into the sport. So how did...
No, that was the thing. As soon as it came, you know, came onto the scene, whatever, that's where I started getting into it. So
uh-huh.
I was actually skiing for maybe a couple of seasons before that.
Mm-hmm.
Before, you know, it became sort of mainstream enough to sort of... be an actual sort of thing that people might play.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was definitely at the time, you know, the most popular sport at the upcoming sport at the time, I guess, wasn't it?
Right. But even there weren't there that many games though. Like I feel like if you look at the list of snowboarding games, there's not a long list.
Well, funny enough, it was Jake's game.
Jake Castle?
Yeah, Boss Studios. What I forgot what it's called. Twisted Edge. Stupid
yes.
name. Twisted Edge. They actually found out that they were releasing the same month or something stupid like that as 1080, but we didn't know about each other's games. So there was definitely another game studio that was thinking about this because they were making it.
Right. I 1080 was not the very first snowboarding game, but it's like it's high on the list of snowboarding games. So it wasn't like, you know, if you look at the nine, you know, Street Fighter 2 wasn't the first fighting game. Street Fighter 2 came out and exploded. And all of a sudden, you know, in 2 years, everyone's making fighting games. I don't feel like there was a game before 1080 that would have exploded in a way where it's like, oh, we all need to make snowboarding games. But somehow you all just recognize this is popular. So we're going to go with this. And then, I mean, you could argue maybe 1080 was that game that became popular. Or Twisted Edge, depending on whose side you're on.
Depends on who you ask.
I've never heard of Twisted Edge.
Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, 1080 was the better game.
Obviously, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of it was a really niche sport,
mm-hmm.
I guess. So nobody really knew if it was going to be popular or not. When
right.
we released it, we didn't think, oh, this is going to be hugely popular. And the reviews initially, I think, were sort of, our internal reviews were quite low with Mario Club. Mario Club is the testing branch of Nintendo. They reviewed it quite low.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't expecting it to be very popular, to be honest. We knew it was a good game, but it didn't score, because it wasn't the typical Nintendo game, it didn't score very well.
And I would imagine to a lot of people, snowboarding is probably, even if they've seen it, they probably are not familiar with how it works. Or,
right,
you know.
Right. Yeah, it's not a thing you'd see on a shelf and go, oh, I want to try that, because you don't know what it is. You know, it's not Mario, it's not a platformer, it's not a shoot 'em up, you know, what is it? And it was a, you know, half simulator, half arcade game, so it wasn't even in a particular genre at that point.
Yeah, because it's a curious game in that you can sit there and you can race, or you can open up the another mode and just sort of do these tricks and try to score points that way. Do you know was it always the plan? Oh, we're just going to do everything you can do on a snowboard, or did it start with one? And you figure, oh, well, if we're doing this, we need to also do this mode, or how?
So I think the way it worked was it's always, as typical with most Nintendo games, they come up with one fundamental idea and they work off that.
Mm-hmm.
So before there's any graphics, before there's any, everything's programmer art, everything's boxes and whatever. If there's a key dynamic that works and it's fun and you keep going back to it, then you've got you've got something there. You've got a hook.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you start putting things like modes and graphics and all that sort of stuff on there. So with 1080, it would have been the core dynamic of you controlling a board going down some snow, and you have total control over that board, how it slides, how it slips and stops, whatever. And how can you make modes? How do you make gameplay out of that dynamic? So that's the process, I think. You build the modes on top of the core dynamic. And that's kind of what we've done with Carve, which is, we've got a really good mechanism for controlling the board, and we've put sort of modes to use that on top of it.
A Carve being your upcoming project.
Yeah, well, I guess I skipped ahead there, but, <didn't I? laughs>
No, we'll just say it out loud at this point. So at this point, this is the upcoming game, which is called Carve. Just Carve?
Carve Snowboarding.
Carve Snowboarding. Okay.
Yeah, and it's for Oculus Quest. Announcing April 21st, releasing May 27th.
May 27th.
Okay. Well, this will definitely go up after the initial announcement, so won't be a surprise. But just for conversation clarity, we're talking about this new game. To go back to the 90s, and you've got this snowboard. You're working on the snowboard game. You've got a skeleton. People seem to like it. You think snowboarding is fun, but the tests poorly. What do you think kept it going? Was it just it tested poorly and you figure, oh, well, it'll be an experiment? Or, was it how did the process work where you get these games tested, and at some point, if it tests so low, it's like, oh, I'll just give up. And it tests, how does that work?
Well, the funny thing is even Nintendo don't know which of their games is going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So they always ignore the tests, test scores. Apart, if it's a Zelda or a Mario, they know it's always going to be 999, whatever.
Right.
But these other games like Pikmin as well, or Wave Race or whatever, they didn't know at the time whether it was going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Just so happened a few of them did. But they knew they were good games, but they just didn't know if they'd sell, because that's such a subjective thing, isn't it? Objectively, there are obviously good games.
Mm-hmm.
Subjectively, it's up to the people buying it whether it sells, and they can't. They can never know. They never knew whether it was going to sell. One of the metrics of how well a game was going to sell was how much money they put into marketing.
Mm.
So they could kind of control it with that. But I think with 1080, they probably because it's a kind of risk title, they wouldn't have put that much money into marketing. So it had that against it at the start as well. Without much marketing, it still did quite well.
Because the game, you start making this game in 1997 for a release in 1998, probably designed to line up with the Nagano Olympics.
Yeah.
And it released in Japan in February of 98, and it came out in America a few months later. It came out in Europe many months later. They actually waited till the next winter to give it to Europe. But you spend 97, you're making this game. You've got hope, you think it's fun, it gets tested, oh, that's disappointing, but it comes out, the marketing, oh, maybe we don't know what's going to happen, but we know it's good. And then it comes out, so what would you say, what was your experience there where it comes out and then you start to get responses from more than just Mario Club and more than, and of course you get the Japanese and then you get different markets too. Like how did that unfold for you?
I think it was just a surprise to see, how much people liked it. And for whatever reasons, there's still hardcore speed trial people that still play it,
mm-hmm.
trying to get the highest, the best speed down the best time down the mountain, and at the time there were people trying to do all of the tricks, get all the tricks, get the fastest scores, whatever, and that happened quite quickly, and they sort of broke the game within weeks, broke the game as in finished the game within days actually. which was really cool to see, actually. There was that much interest so quickly in the game. It wasn't a slow burn. It was like immediately very popular.
Hmm.
But I mean, I guess it's quite a completionist game where you've got so many tricks to do, all the boards, the characters. There's like two or three hidden characters. There's a couple of hidden boards, or whatever. So you know, if you're a completionist, that it's quite a good game to get into, I think. So maybe that was part of it. But I think just generally it has a replayability because the physics and stuff are quite consistent. So you have a curve where initially it's actually quite difficult to play, but there's such a tail end on that curve that you can just keep playing it for months and still get better and better and better. And I think that's maybe why it also had quite a long tail end sales as well.
So steep curve, but high ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A steep initial curve. And once you get past that, you realize it can go so much higher than that. This is a test. This is only a test. This is a test. This station is conducting a test on the emergency broadcast system. This is a test.
I'm intrigued by this because, you know, I don't have the game on hand, so I had to sort of just review some video footage. And one thing that really struck me, you know, I remember the game at the time, but didn't play it that much. And so in revisiting it, I think I was really surprised by just how fast the game feels, like just in motion.
Mm.
And by all means, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I look at this game, I think of it, you know, I see a lot of racing games. Racing games have always been popular. But when you're snowboarding, even if you're racing with someone, let's be honest, you're basically falling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is a sport where you're falling down as fast as you can, but not too fast that you hurt yourself. And I was really surprised about how, when I watched this game in motion, I felt tension from watching the little characters move faster and faster and faster. And I was like, this is frightening to me.
Mm.
You know, yes, I'm easily frightened, but the point is that I think that probably adds to the excitement. I don't know. Like, what's your perspective?
You're exactly right about the falling down the mountain thing. But basically, with snowboarding, what you're doing is trying to not fall down the mountain constantly. You're trying to not go too fast or not fall over or not do whatever. It's not about trying to go fast. You're trying to not go too fast. And because 1080 was a very physics-based thing, we spent a lot of time getting the frictions and the slope angles and all that right to make it feel like you're falling down but still controllable. I think that's why you get that feeling, because you're literally doing that in the game. You're falling down the mountain.
So did you have to experiment with like how fast can we go and how fast can we not go? And
so much experimentation. We tried every combination of, because the other thing is when you have a camera that's pointing down a mountain, at the same angle as the mountain, you can't tell you're on a steep slope or a slight slope, whatever, because there's no reference point.
Right.
So that was really hard, getting the feeling that you're going down a mountain, even when you are sort of 80 degrees going down the mountain, it doesn't look like you are.
Right.
So how do we do that and stuff like that? It was really hard to keep that sense of danger in the game. And it's all about the camera movement and the movement of the player, whatever. That's what it's less about the speed, actually. It's more about how the camera reacts to things. And the FOV of the camera drastically changes the sense of speed.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried different FOVs. I think the current one, or the one we went with, was actually quite wide, like 60 degrees or something like that, rather than the normal sort of 50.
So speaking of player movement, obviously the Nintendo 64 had a distinct controller, and it sort of introduced the analog stick, I would say, to a lot of people. It wasn't the first analog stick. I know this. You can save your emails. But it was an influential analog stick, and that must have been probably the centerpiece of your work is like, well, how adjusting inputs from this stick to the characters.
Yeah, it was one of the reasons for making the game, actually, is the analog stick.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of Miyamoto-san's full project for probably many years, actually. He was trying to get that stick, right? And we went through so many prototypes of the controller to finally arrive at the fantastic controller that it has. But it's a fundamental part of all of the games that came out at that point. Like, you know, Mario 64 was all about the 3D control using the stick.
Mm-hmm.
1080 was all about the fine left and right control and the tilting control and all that. And also the trigger button, which was, you know, quite new at the time, I think.
Now, I've got, before I go on, I have to say, so in my mind right now, I'm trying to imagine the line of prototypes that didn't make it to arrive at the one that we got.
Yeah.
So are there any chimeras that come to mind of like, that was just a nightmare of like, this one was a, no, that was obviously not going to work. Cause the one that we got with, I mean, I used it. I have affection for it, but it's quirky. It's a little weird and some people hate it. I don't agree with those people. But
it was,
trying to imagine what were the rejects? If that was the winner, what were the rejects like?
Well, I still think it's a brilliant controller because it's ambidextrous. Mm-hmm. You know, you can decide whether, I think Miyamoto's wanted a Juji key on both sides rather than the buttons on one side and the Juji key on the left.
Right, like Virtual Boy, double D-pads.
Yeah, yeah, because that would make it truly left or right. You could choose whether the middle stick was in your right hand or your left hand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was his only regret. But I think that was the key feature, was the fact that it didn't matter how you hold it. If you wanted to hold it with your right hand, you could. If you want left hand, you could. Because there was no concept of the current Xbox sort of PlayStation type controller.
Right.
We had at the time. We had sort of those, trying to make a Famicom shape with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
We had those, but nothing that you hold with both hands like a controller, the current controllers, if you know what I mean.
Right, but even at some point, you know, the PlayStation debuts in Japan in 94.
Right.
So there's a full year and a half in between PlayStation existing and Nintendo 64 launching in Japan. So at some point, someone had to show them, like, well, here's this thing. You could put sticks on here, but... They're like, no, I'm good. I want to twist it.
Yeah, yeah. They wanted the flexibility of being able to use both hands. I think that was a really key thing. Because they didn't know whether people wanted to use their right hand or the left hand to do the main controlling, basically.
Ah.
I think that was the thing. Because the stick was on the middle, wasn't it? So
yes.
you could choose whether it was your left hand or right hand doing the actual control. I mean, for some games, I actually, you know, I'm right-handed, but I use my left hand to control it.
Hmm.
So I still like the controller, even though it's obviously dated now.
Well, I mean, in the end, I think it worked out, and there were some games that took advantage of the stick in unusual ways. I believe GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, I actually offered a double stick option. You can actually hold a controller in each hand, and, you know, now that's the norm. But at the time, I remember seeing that on the option menu at the time. I was like, wait, what? Well, that means only two players, but okay.
Mm.
And it never, then a couple of years after that, it's like, oh, well, that's what we're all going to do that now. We've all agreed.
And they did try other, you know, odd things like having force feedback on the stick. Well, not so much force feedback, but being able to control where it can move, how far it can move. They got a UK company, I think, to make this joystick that you could limit the range of movement it had. And I made some prototypes of it. You know, you control in a Mario character, but when you get to a wall and the camera can't go any further, it would stop the stick from moving any further.
Oh, like physically,
physically stop it.
Stop, you couldn't move the stick anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And it kind of worked, but it wasn't high fidelity enough to be actually usable, I think.
Hmm.
And another idea was to have, you know, it's sort of vibrate in and out slightly so it felt like a texture. Almost. Ooh. You know, if you had a slippery wall versus a bumpy wall, you could differentiate. But it didn't have enough high frequency to be able to do that, really.
Well, I think in hindsight, we're lucky we didn't go with those ideas, because as soon as Mario Party came out, those things would have just exploded.
Yeah,
you know, one round of this. I'm doing the wax on, wax off motion, listeners, but one round of that would have just torn that stick right off.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't very robust, were they? I think a lot of the ideas were thrown out because they knew they would it would last probably a week before they got broken.
Hmm. We went on a tangent about the sticks, but let's get back to the slopes. Yeah, I see you smirking. They're S words. It's a good segue. So, yeah, you were just saying about how you wish you had kept more stuff because a lot of it just ended up getting tossed.
I don't mean steal stuff.
No, I mean I keep. I didn't say steal. I said keep.
Giles is pretty avid keep.
Keep person.
Yeah. Keep and steal are totally different words. They have different letters.
Or just at least catalog some of it. Or done something with it rather than just throw it in the bin, like I'm sure a lot of it was.
Well, I see here in our here in this office space right now, I can see there's some collectibles over here. I see the electro gun,
that's fantastic.
A cowboy game.
Mark found that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a Nintendo game, which is amazing. I didn't even know they made those kind of things.
I think it's a Gunpo Yokoi creation, I believe.
Yeah.
And their office is actually literally one block away.
Oh. There.
Kato's office.
You know, actually, since I just brought him up, I'm curious. Did you, by any chance, happen to work with Yokoi at all, or did you just miss him?
No, I mean, he was in a different department anyway. Oh. It was kind of, I guess, a bit before my time, maybe, or in a different office anyway. So, we weren't allowed to move between offices.
Oh, then. Okay.
The buildings, actually. I think he was R&D 2, or maybe R&D 3, maybe.
No Yokoi stories. That's fine. Not everyone can meet Gunpo Yokoi. I certainly haven't met Gunpo Yokoi.
You could go up to Koto, knock on the door, and say, "Tell me about your boss."
Believe me, it's a dream. It's a dream that I've had. I want to go over there someday.
They're very friendly people.
They're just like 100 meters from
literally,
our door, right?
Literally.
Like,
we'll save that for the next episode, I think, or after I have a beer.
Good man.
So getting back to the snowboarding game, the 1080 snowboarding game. This is perhaps off topic, but it is about the game where I just mentioned. Do you perhaps know where this game name came from? Because it's kind of weird. It's kind of an unusual game in that, you know, you look it up in Japanese and it's not the number even. It's like it's just the katakanas 1080 snowboarding, and maybe that was not your department at all. But how did you think about this game coming out? And just it's a number. Does that put it at the top of the list alphabetically? Was that the strategy?
Yeah, actually, I have a feeling it was me. That came up with the name.
Really?
But it was basically the best trick you could do.
Yeah.
You know, for 1080 spins, whatever. Mm-hmm. 5 spins, whatever it is. How many spins is it?
That would be 3 spins.
3 spins.
360, 720, 1080.
Yeah. That's what it was. It was the best spin you could do, or the best trick you could do. So that was the goal of the game, was to do a 1080, which is now considered quite a lame trick to do.
And you said, well, that's the best thing, so let's just name this game after the best thing you can do in the game.
Yeah, which shows how dated it is, because now that's quite, you know, that's a pretty lame trick to do. 3 spins, whatever, that's without even flips. And now it's like sort of quadruple, double, triple flips with grabbing whatever. But at the time, you know, it's interesting to see the progression of what is classed as a good trick then versus now.
Oh, sure. That applies to every sport, but absolutely in snowboarding, sure.
Yeah. And now the tricks are just so extreme that you kind of wonder where it ends.
Well, I'm curious, from your standpoint as a programmer, as someone making this game, what happens during the process of making the game? Do you have to decide where the limits go? Do you have to decide, oh, here's what people are doing, so we should make the character do these things only? Or do you say, well, what if we made what if we just went NBA Jam style and you get up there and you do 20 spins and the board explodes? Like, are those conversations happening, or just like, oh, Let's rein it in. Let's not go that weird.
Well, the way I go about it is by just making the physics right.
Mm-hmm.
and then it's up to you to decide what you do in it. So it's like a sandbox almost. And then we put limits on to say, all right, you can't spin 9 times or you can't jump 3,000 feet in the air. But, you know, if you have the fundamental core physics correct, then you have all this other stuff for free almost.
And I guess so would you say maybe the core authenticity perhaps helps sell the game to the audience? Like, oh, well, if it feels right, then it feels right. And then you don't have to worry about the fantasy stuff.
I guess, but that's not what I think about when I'm making it. Well, okay. All I can really do when I make games is make them realistic, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
I'm not very good at making games that look like they're supposed to be realistic but aren't, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
I can only really approach it from a very sort of Newtonian type physics point of view and say, all right, these are the dynamics I want. This is how it's going to move. And I'll get that right. I don't really sort of approach it from the other angle, if that makes any sense.
Okay, I get it.
So the gameplay comes out of that fundamental physics stuff.
But in the game, there are certain elements that couldn't exist on a real mountain. Like there are slopes that have like fireballs and things on them.
No, I wish I'd done that. Oh, well, you mean on 1080?
Yes.
No, they're not fireballs. They're flame torches, whatever.
Okay. Oh, they're just...
Everything in the game, as far as I know, apart from maybe the penguin... physically possible.
Oh, okay. I thought I saw fire ring somewhere on the dragon's cave stage.
There is a fire ring, isn't there?
Yes.
No, you're right. There is a fire ring, but you could still do that if you wanted in real life. Yeah.
I mean, Evel Knievel did it.
Yeah, yeah.
Rest his soul.
It would go out quite quickly, but you could do it. So, yeah, I'm always reluctant to... I mean, this is a bit of my... I get told off a lot for doing this. Sorry. I get told off for... putting my foot down on ideas that sound like they're fun or people think that it's going to be fun, but if I think they're not realistic enough, I wouldn't put them in. I'm trying to think of a specific case, but I don't know if it breaks the fundamental physics in some way that I think is too separated from reality, then I won't put it in. But I'm always willing to put stuff limits to the reality in, if you know what I mean. Limits or sort of slight tweaks to the reality. So it's kind of a fine balance between sort of keeping it real but still making it fun.
So that's something that sounds like it would apply a lot to the upcoming Carve game then, because that seems like if you're doing VR stuff, you're probably going for a realism angle.
Yeah, more so with Carve because you're in the physical space, you kind of have to match what the board is doing all the time, or rather the board matches what you're doing. So you can't really do weird, ridiculous moves that you can't do in real life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons we don't have things like backflips and forward flips in there, because you couldn't really do that in VR without making it feel too detached. You can do spins, but we thought flips were just too detached from reality.
So the likelihood of fireballs in Carver, very low.
Fireballs, we've got tons of them.
Oh, fire, okay. All right. For Legacy, their grandfather did.
Oh, yeah.
I guess since we brought it up, what would you say drew you back to this snowboarding idea 20 plus years later? I was like, oh, well, was it just the appeal of doing it in a new format, or just the fact that you always liked that game, or the fact that you perhaps are doing, you play the sport now and you like it more? What happened there?
All of those things.
I've
only got more and more into snowboarding since my kids have taken it up. Mm. Now all my kids do it. You know, they've all been doing it since they were three, whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of always have to go almost every weekend. So I just get more into it the older I get almost. So there's that. There's also the fact that there aren't any good snowboarding games out there. All the games that I've seen tend to be too extreme or too try to do everything, skiing, snowboarding, skating, blah, 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 or wingsuiting. You know, I'm not saying steep in particular, but, you know, steep type games that try to do everything, but I don't think does one thing particularly well. So the idea of just having one game, you know, a snowboarding game that just does snowboarding really well is just really appealing to me. So that's why I just wanted to make it. And I'm always surprised that more people don't make those very focused games nowadays. Seems to be a very 90s, 80s game to make.
Well, I would imagine at this point, the problem is that probably as budgets are up and, you know, 3D graphics and everything costs more to do, I guess everyone figures, oh, well, if we're making a new game now, we have to get the, we have to cast the biggest net, you know, broadcasting versus narrowcasting.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's, I think there's still enough people playing games for there to be niche markets.
Oh, yes. That's what I hope. That's what I hope the lesson people are learning from the current games industry is.
And that's why indie's quite, you know, you're so popular as it is. So I think there is, obviously you have the AAAs and you have indies, and I think there's a big enough market in indies to have niche games like, say, Carve. Mm. I don't think it's a niche game, but maybe it is. So yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, I guess it might be niche in the sense that you are appealing to the VR market. So you have to, you know, you are, it's a subset of the larger games market, but it is, it's a sizable subset and it's one that gets a lot of attention.
Yeah, Carve kind of needs to be VR for its full potential, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or the snowboarding game needs to be for its full potential to feel like you're actually playing it in real life. But that was the idea behind Carve, at least, is to make it feel like you're playing in real life.
Jump in here. Giles, what is Carve snowboarding for Oculus Quest? I feel like we've been talking about that it's niche, but I mean...
I don't know. What is it? It's a snowboarding game for the Quest.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Giles.
It is definitely a snowboarding game. I believe you.
Yeah, it is. It, as a matter of fact.
There's like, carving. You can carve in it.
Great.
I don't know. I have not been asked that, so I haven't prepared an answer.
Okay.
Let me think of one.
Okay. We should have PR bullet points in case he does get asked that question.
Okay. Yeah.
The world's first realistic VR snowboarding game. How's that?
Based on 1080 snowboarding spiritually.
I'm a bit worried to say 1080 snowboarding. Because I like having my knees on me.
Oh, right.
Well, we didn't spell 1080, so that could be spelled in a different way. Yeah, so, you know, true. That could be spelled with a Q in there somewhere. Well, actually, that's Q Games. spell with an X. Put an X in there. People love X's.
That's X, game X.
All right. We'll pick.
There are the letters.
Yeah, you've got a team upstairs. I saw them. They look very intelligent. I'm sure they can find one letter that'll. They can just claim for their own, like, all right, we're putting this in there, and now it's...
I think they're all illiterate, actually.
It's the sports entertainment version, you know? If you misspell it, you can own it. Like China with a Y.
China with a Y. Oh.
Kaz with two Zs. There we go. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. You just, if you spell it differently, it's yours.
But what if we put a dollar sign, and then it's 1080?
$1080?
Yeah.
That would be 1,000 yen plus tax, but only if you eat in versus take out because the tax rate is different now.
Oh,
I'm sorry, that's some niche Japanese
that's
humor
right
there. How
much it should have been. It should have been 1080.
Our game should have cost 1080. Fuck.
$10.80.
So this project, I would imagine, has been in the works for a few years now, the Carve?
Yeah, quite a few years, maybe 5 years. We've shown it at like two bit summits. Last time we had a Bit Summit was like 2 years ago, so yeah, quite a long time ago.
Yes, I miss Bit Summit very badly.
Yeah, we all do. This year, next year. So it's been tweaked and tweaked and tweaked and experimented on various audiences, you know, really fine-tuned, I think is the word. We've actually taken it all over the world. It's been to the French Alps. It's been to the UK, parts of Japan. Spain, I think.
To the best of your knowledge, has it been played on top of an actual mountain?
Yes.
Yes.
One of the ski resorts in France.
So someone went to the top of the mountain, and before they actually did the real game, it's like, well, wait, let me try this virtual simulation of snowboarding.
When I say top of the mountain, I mean a ski resort at the top of the mountain.
Yes. That's fantastic.
And interestingly enough, it was the skiers that were most interested in playing it, rather than the boarders.
Of course, of course.
Because they...
The forbidden fruit.
They, you know... They're not allowed to play it, or they're not allowed to use the snowboard, or they're really curious about what this weird sport is like. So they were really into it.
It's like me playing Grand Theft Auto 3 in 2001. It's like, right. I can't actually commit crimes or do jumps in cars, but yeah. Now I can with polygons.
Yeah. And the age group was just all over the place. Like youngsters, old people, whatever, they all loved it. There was no specific demographic that tended to play it more than others, which is quite interesting.
Well, perhaps we could jump backwards a little bit just to cover the gap in time between snowboard 1080 snowboarding existing and being popular to you creating your own company here at Vitae, because that's a period of about 4 or 5 years. What happened in there?
Drugs.
Okay.
No.
I'm not a cop.
So I left Nintendo.
Yeah.
Not entirely sure why. Started my own thing, and then went back to Nintendo as a sort of freelancer and did a few projects with them. One of them being Doshin the Giant, I think, on the N60, on the GameCube.
Ah.
Kyojin or Doshin, whatever it's called. Remember, I think I helped out on 1080 Avalanche a bit at some point.
The GameCube sort of sequel.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And then we did some other projects for Nintendo's Theta and some 3DS games, DS games, stuff like that for a few years.
Right. Well, that's more recent memory. But
it's all one big blur to me.
I get you. You've always had, since you came over, I guess, so since you first arrived here, you've always had this relationship with Nintendo. And just for a few years there, you were literally in Nintendo. And then you've just been sort of near Nintendo. And that's just where you sort of... You've hung out for
yeah.
For now.
When I started Vitae originally, we were sort of 1.5 party. We weren't first party, we weren't third party, we weren't second party. So we were kind of like part an extension of EAD or NCL at least for quite a few years. So we were sort of almost part of Nintendo, and then we sort of split off to do other things. Quite recently actually, the last couple of years. I think it's basically since Iwata-san passed away, when Nintendo sort of changed focus from, concentrating more on the big titles, which is, the best thing we could have done, I think, is to sort of cut the umbilical cord, as it were.
So Vitae, I must ask, as a name, does Vitae mean life, or where does that name come from?
Apparently it's a bucket for... feeding donkeys or something in Italian.
Okay.
It's literally a 5-letter domain name that I bought.
Oh.
I made a program to find all the 5-letter domain names that are available.
Ah, okay.
And it was one of 50 that came up, so I bought like 10, and it was one of those. It means nothing to me. I hate the name.
What you don't know about Giles is he buys any domain.
I use domain names as a to-do list of projects that I've not done.
So it's funny, since you mentioned 3DS, I was curious because I know Vitae worked on one of the initial games, the submarine game, right? Which
Subwars.
Steel Diver?
Steel Diver.
Yes. Which had its roots, I think, in early Nintendo. Like that was an old. Was that an old idea for Miyamoto, or
it was Sugiyama?
Sugiyama.
Yeah, it was his little prototype idea for. I'm trying to think what you may know that better than I do. It was for some show that they made, but it was a demo, a little prototype demo that he made. And then they said, "Let's make this into a proper game using the touch panel as the control input." So we did. We made it for DS. I'm trying to think what the timeline was. There was, we made it for the original DS, and then it came out with the DS Lite, maybe. We added more features for that. And then we made it again for the 3DS, I think.
the reason I bring it up, besides the fact that you brought it up earlier, is the fact that I think about VR and I think about the 3DS, and, you know, this is me as a not technical person, but to me, those are similar in the sense that they're both systems that are working with each eyeball. I'm poking my eyeballs here, listeners, and to create this sort of 3D effect that makes the brain think, oh, I'm seeing things that are, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wonder, is there any correlation there, or am I just
a correlation between,
like, when you make a game in 3D for the 3DS and then now you're making a game for VR, is it totally different process, or is it anything related at all?
That's a good point. No.
No. All right.
You really built that one up.
It's a swing and a miss. It's all right.
No, but that's an interesting point. Maybe there is. There maybe is on a technical level.
Yeah.
I.e., you're rendering a stereo image in both mm-hmm. of those cases. But on the gameplay side, that's taken care of in a different part of the programming, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So at the gameplay side, you're just making a 3D game.
Okay.
How it's displayed, whether it's displayed on stereo image display or a single image display or whatever, it doesn't really affect the gameplay. So I guess I can see the similarities. Yeah, there are certain things that probably had to happen lower down in the hardware that are similar to what we're doing now. So yes and no.
Okay, I'll take that. That's not a strikeout.
It's more of a bunt.
Yeah. I got on base. I'll take it.
It's interesting. That's the first time I've thought about that, actually, whether there are similarities.
All right. Then I'll accept that good question. Thank you very much. That means a lot to me. Where do we go from here? I know this is Retronauts, where we talk about old games, but you've got this Vitae Studio. Well, actually, perhaps you can clarify this point for me, because I'm an outsider, but I know there's Vitae. And there's Chuhai Labs, and what is that relation? So Vitae is more of the Nintendo stuff, and Chuhai Labs is like whatever we want to do?
No, Vitae is the company.
Okay.
Chuhai Labs is the brand, or the
it's the face.
It's the face of the company.
Oh, okay.
A bit like, I know, Google is... Alphabet owns Google.
Oh, okay.
Google is the brand, or the company, not the company, the thing.
Hmm.
It's a thing. Chuhai Labs is a thing we've got going.
Okay, and we're sitting here inside this thing.
In this thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
The end of this thing.
Yeah, we just, when we developed Chuhai Labs, we just wanted it to be a lot, Vitae isn't silly. It isn't represent us, and we wanted an entity that was us, and it was a lot easier to get behind something with a silly logo like the Chuhai Labs flask
mm-hmm.
than Vitae, which half of people can't pronounce, and some people think it's a Latin word, some people think it's a Italian word for donkey bucket. Chuhai Labs, it's a lot simpler. So
also, for, you know, most of Vitae's life, we weren't allowed to say to anybody that we existed.
Oh.
So,
like a Tose kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Nintendo used us, not used us, but Nintendo sort of told us to, you know, keep quiet about our involvement with them.
Hmm.
So we did so many prototypes and things that were never disclosed, whatever. So it's Chuhai is us sort of coming out and sort of actually existing rather than hiding behind Nintendo.
And before we started recording, you were telling me that, Mark, you were telling me that you're working on multiple games at this point?
Yeah, right now we're working on, like, in the studio, we're working on, Giles is making a very odd motion to me. We're working on a...
Oh, sorry.
Oh, shit.
The yellow thing.
Yeah, well, this is an audio podcast, Giles.
Okay. I saw that in the background,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, right now we're working on the Quest game, Carve, snowboarding. We're also working on a Playdate launch title.
Hmm.
Which can't say on this podcast because it's, but you're seeing it right now in front of you.
Yes, listeners, I've been handed a Playdate, the, I would say, Famicom disc sized handheld that has the crank on it. At this time, I don't know. Has that system have a launch date at this point? Or
no.
I don't think so.
No, they have not announced anything yet.
This is not the first time I've held this thing, but it's the first time I've held it since Bit Summit, I think. And yeah, it's got a little game on it.
Yeah, and we're also working on a Switch title, and we're working on We're doing some contract work for Universal Studios Japan.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's our second project with them. Our first one being Lupin XR Ride.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you've been on that, but it's great.
So you've been working with them on VR stuff then?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. The first VR roller coaster, wasn't it?
Yeah, I went there a few years ago, and I think I rode there was a Final Fantasy sort of thing. Yeah. And while I was moving along a very simple track, the images were there, and Cloud and Sephiroth were there, and they were fighting, and then they kissed, and then it was just, you know, everything I ever dreamed of.
Fantastic. Cloud and Sephiroth kissed at the end?
I'm sorry, we can cut that out, right?
Yeah, I'm down for that.
We'll cut that out. No, I'm kidding. No, it was all the
fanfic. Because I'm for it.
Is that a thing?
Cloud and Sephiroth kissing at the end of a roller coaster.
No, someone's created that. I said it out loud, but I'm sure someone has already made that.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, it just wasn't
now.
At USJ.
They will now, won't they?
Oh yeah, and so we're working with USJ on the world's largest VR
attraction.
Oh,
we're pretty excited about that, actually. No release date on that, and we can't announce it, unfortunately.
I understand.
Yeah. But it's the biggest, best VR thing we've ever done, certainly. But not to detract from Carve, which is
the biggest, best,
the biggest, bestest snowboarding game we've ever done.
Have you been to Super Nintendo World yet?
No.
No, not yet.
We tried. We failed.
I thought you went.
I didn't go.
Wow.
Okay. I wanted to go.
I'm meaning to go, but as of this recording, I have not gone yet, unfortunately. It looks exciting.
I know lots of people that have gone. I want to go. I think we should go.
Let's all go together.
Yes. We can't go today, though. Unfortunately, they've already closed. Yeah. But perhaps another day.
You should go there and do a podcast.
That is my full intention.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I absolutely want to podcast from Super Nintendo World.
That would be pretty tight.
But I guess if that is the extent of our conversation, perhaps we should sort of wrap us up with something you'd like to talk about, something you haven't discussed yet that you want to share with the world about Vitae or Chuhai or Carve or 1080p or, you know, what Mr. Miyamoto prefers to wear when he's not on stage.
What does he wear, actually?
He doesn't.
He doesn't? Okay, right.
You know, it's... He doesn't wear anything in the office.
He goes back to the box like a robot and turns off.
Yeah. He likes a simple life. He doesn't like clothes and stuff like that.
Oh, good. So, yeah, at Chuhai Labs, we've got a lot. We've got our own podcast coming out called Nasty Labs with starring Kinsey and myself, Kinsey Burke. And we also have a few YouTube shows coming out. And we're hopefully, as of this podcast, going to be joining the Greenlit Podcast Network along with Retronauts and your CEO, Jeremy Parrish. And as soon as all this is over, anybody is welcome to come to our office and get really drunk or not drunk with us, depending.
And we're going to have Mega Knights again.
And yes, Mega Knight is our series of the fuckest uppest.
Well, if we could rephrase that without profanity, it's an open evening for people to come visit and
play games, hang out with other game devs. It's like a kind of mini bit summit, isn't it? Almost.
Hmm. Yes, I have attended. I have attended these events in the past.
And you attended the good ones as well.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I didn't.
They were all good. They only ever got better, and then we had to stop because of COVID.
Hmm.
But they will be back.
So I guess we can each individually perhaps go out. Marcus, what would you like to say before we end up? Is there anything you personally have that you want to talk about? Or
yeah, actually. So I've been on Retronauts twice now.
Yes.
One time with my old boss, Dylan Cuthbert.
That's true.
Now with my current boss, Giles. And I've got to be on the podcast with both of this ex-Star Fox team. And I'm missing the third Star Fox. Krista
Womble.
Yeah.
We should have him on. Can you do a Krista Womble? The third Star Fox programmer.
Where are they at this point?
I think he's in Singapore.
Oh, all right.
Let's call them up.
That would require some travel arrangements, but it's possible.
Similar time zone.
It's close. It's close time-wise, but also not distance. It's far. Yep. It's an 8-hour flight.
I wanted to thank you personally for letting me on the podcast again. Retronauts is probably the reason that I'm in video games. More than video games themselves, it was Jeremy and 1UP.com and Retronauts that really attracted me to the allure of video games and made me aware that there's like a culture behind it. So I thank you.
Nope, not at all. I'm happy to be here and talk to people about their experiences and their things. Do you have anything specific as far as Mark, as far as you go, as Twitter or perhaps your band? I know you are in a band.
Yeah, I am in a band. You can find me on Twitter at The Henry Demos, and I'm in a band called Nice Legs. We are a Kyoto-based duo. We've been in silly movies, and we're hopefully going to be doing a lot more music this year once this thing wraps up.
Mm.
But yeah.
And Giles, is there anything you'd like to personally share? I don't know, if social media or just a personal project or anything at all?
Well, I'd like to thank Retronauts and you, Daniel.
Okay.
For coming.
Thank you.
All the way from Osaka.
Thank you for hosting.
Even though there's
me.
A pandemic on, which I think is very cool of you to do. I'd like to ask Mark to marry me. No, to which is your favorite Star Fox programmer?
Well, I haven't met Chris.
Oh, you haven't met Chris.
Right. So that's kind of fucked up.
Right. I don't have any further questions.
Okay. Before we wrap up, though, I just did realize one more thing I remembered. In the credits of 1080 Snowboarding, you have a credit as a voice actor.
Mm, yeah.
What was that? What happened?
Winty?
Ricky Winterbourne.
Ricky Winterbourne, the Canadian.
The Canadian.
Yes.
Good for looking that up. And what does he say, Giles?
Sure, I'll do it.
And I believe he says, all right.
All right.
Yeah, that's it.
He also says things like, ah, and, and a few other, not pronounceable things. Yeah, I didn't know he was going to be Canadian. Otherwise, I would have done a Canadian accent.
I was going to ask if you worked with a dialect coach because of your flawless performance.
I think the guy recording this didn't really know that there was any difference between Canadian, American, and British, whatever.
Was that recorded here in Japan then?
Yeah, in the NCL studio. And I remember specifically because it took like a day to record oomps and ahs and all day, 8 hours, nonstop. And they used like maybe one or two samples from the thing.
Yeah, if you hit the wall with his character, it's just It's pretty great.
So that's why I realized that I never want to be doing that kind of stuff again.
So your first and last voice work then?
Yeah.
All right.
Being locked in a room just making weird grunting noises for 8 hours is not fun.
So does that mean Carve will not have any voice acting? Or just will you have other people
do
it?
We do have a grunt. We have a professional grunter.
Oh.
We have some great voice acting in Carve, actually.
We do. It's we've got Michael Swaim. He works over at IGN.
I know Michael Swaim, yes.
Yeah. He's going to be doing a character named Carve Edgerton. And it's like there's an incidental radio in the background, and he's just giving the mountain and weather updates. And it's a very nonsensical story that he's building to. So he'll talk about the weather and then talk about puppy mills. And talk about leveling the mountain so they can make way for the mayor's son to do X or Y or whatever.
And the mayor's son is? That's a secret, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the secret. Oh, that's the secret. And we also have another guy as guy locked in the bathroom. And if you ever go up to the bathroom door and knock on it, he'll say something like, "Hey, dude, where's my taco?" And that's
Stoner dude.
The stoner dude, yeah. And that's a guy named Mark Holcomb. He's a pretty well-known metal guitarist.
All right. Well, I'm glad I asked that last question before I forgot to ask it. Oh. In the meantime, since we'll wrap it up, I will give the official plug for Retronauts. We are a podcast you're listening to right now. We have our own website, retronauts.com. We have a new episode for free for everyone on Mondays. We also have a premium exclusive episode for our patrons only. That's patreon.com/retronauts. We have two premium episodes per month as of this recording, possibly more in the future. I don't know. This could very well be a premium episode because we might be doing more Japanese episodes. But as of this recording, I can't say for sure. But you, the listener, might know more than I do. That's the magic of you living in the future, because that's where we're going to spend the rest of our lives. Beyond that, of course, patrons who subscribe for at least $5 also get a free column every week from me. I write a column and then record a MIDI podcast about retro anniversaries, and I'm very proud to do that. As far as me personally, you can find me on most services like Twitch, YouTube, Twitter as Fight Club, F-E-I-T, my last name, C-L-U-B. And yeah, I stream games sometimes. I tend to focus on retro games. And yeah, I'm here in Japan doing Japanese things, and I had a nice conversation with you here. Thank you very much for hosting me in this lovely studio / drinking establishment. And to everyone out there listening, matane.
Matane.